Hi, we've been making our way through the book of Esther, and we pretty much got it done. We covered chapter 10 the last time we had a Sunday evening service, and 9 and 10 really. What I'd like to do is take this sermon and perhaps two more that I have prepared, or reasonably prepared, and then we'll complete the book of Esther. What I want to do is kind of to go a little bit of an overview. So if you have your Bible, you might want to really follow along. We'll look at a number of passages here. But I titled this Silent Providence. So what do you think? Think with me. When we use the word providence, that used to be a much more popular word. Like in the founding of our country, a lot of the founders and a lot of their writings, they use the word providence a lot. Not real common as much today. You might kind of help understand it when you think in terms of provide. Okay, a little loose there, but provide, providence. Here's what it is. Providence is simply the idea that God rules. Simply the idea that there is a God and that God is orchestrating things and events and issues and that we have the opportunity to acknowledge him as the one who is at work and who is doing these things and really acknowledge him. So providence, what do you want to call it? God's hand, God's working, God's rule. You want to call it God's reign or sovereignty, that sort of thing. And there's a number of things in the book of Esther that can really help us with that. Now, just by way, I hope, of review, you got to keep these three people in mind, these characters, Esther, Mordecai, and Haman. Now, if I took that slide off, who is who? Okay. You've got two guys, they're the confusing ones, but you have one lady. Esther's kind of the hero, right? She's the Jewish queen in Persia, or Jewish queen of Persia in Persia. And then you have Mordecai. He's the good guy. He's the Jewish uncle, if you will, of Esther. Whether he was uncle or cousin or exactly, we can't be really careful because they weren't really careful with those kind of records, as you know, from reading Kings and Chronicles and that sort of thing. But nonetheless, definitely related and definitely became kind of a stepfather to Esther. So you've got Esther and Mordecai, both Jewish people, both Hebrews, both God's chosen people. Then you have the villain. Okay, Haman really is the villain, and I love this book, and really am looking forward to just making our way through a number of issues here. But ultimately, in the book of Esther, as you're well aware, I believe, is Haman was a very powerful man. When I say he was a villain, you don't want to think he was stupid. You don't want to think he was unintelligent. You don't want to think he was not accomplished. You don't want to think he's not popular. None of those things. The big problem with Haman is he didn't know God, he didn't follow God, didn't want to know God, and he was very worldly. He was very into power and prestige and that sort of thing, and he worked to curry that. And he found Mordecai to be a bit of a threat to that, and ultimately he set in motion a plot to exterminate all the Jews in the kingdom. Okay, so those three, Esther, Mordecai, Haman. Now, what we want to look at tonight is this idea of providence. Oh, I also put there the main character. You know, we've got these three characters, but the main character in all of the Bible, as well as in all of life, is God. The question that we could ask ourselves as we begin is, do we see God as the main character in our lives? Individually, do we affirm, even if we are if we're not trusting Christ as Savior, then we're not even God's child. We have no idea who God is. We have no true understanding of him because he has not enlightened, illuminated our hearts and minds. And so the things of God are foolishness to the person who is unsaved. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge and wisdom. And things start getting properly in place when God is in his rightful place in our heart and mind and thinking. Having said that, as believers, it's very possible to make our way through the book of Esther or any other book in the Bible or any of life and not really see, sense, be aware, not believe that God really is at work in our lives and kind of miss it. That's an amazing thing to think, that we could actually make our way through life, and only later, maybe not until we get to heaven, look back and see all these innumerable, you could say virtually infinite ways that God was always at work in our lives. Different things that we heard or that we said or that happened to us that we just kind of dismissed as just coincidental, random nothingness, when in fact God was at work in us, and we can miss wonderful opportunities to learn about him and to serve him. So he is the main character, of course. In Esther, God is not mentioned, but God is not missing. I know what I've done here. I have a wrong setting on here, I think. Let me go with that. God is not mentioned, which is an amazing thing. And I've gone over this before with us, but he's not missing. And then providence, this evidence of God's design. That's what we want to look at tonight. I've got 11 points for you, so we'll blow right through them pretty quickly. But just this evidence of God's design, of God's hand, of God's work. The idea that we look back now and we're going to read something that happened many, many years ago, many centuries ago. And so when we look at this book and this kind of this narrative, we'll see a lot of different things that happened that right now we look back, and hopefully it's really obvious that God did that and that God was at work. But I think what our challenge is not to just know these things. That's just history. But to know God better in these things, to know that the exact same God is doing the same kind of things in our lives, and to look for him. And to believe him, and to put faith in him, and to act in our lives. To act, I don't mean act like a hypocrite, I mean but to act out our faith. To act based on faith. To live our lives in confidence, in faith, in belief that God, in fact, will show up. That God will do exactly what he said, even though it doesn't look like he is doing it at all at a time. So God's providential rule in Esther. I've got 11 examples, and for the most part, these points are taken from a book that I read years ago called Not by Chance by Leighton Talbert. Strong recommendation for that. I've mentioned it here before. Really good book. He wrote 3 books. This was the first one. I just bought the 3rd one that he just came out with, and I'll read that one too. And I read the 2nd one. But anyway, if you're interested, I've got it. Okay. Number 1. Providence. Esther becomes the queen. I hope this is review for most of you. But if you look at chapter 1, verse 10, 11, and 12, you have this situation where the king, Esther's not the queen, but the king in verse 10, he has this huge drinking party. I mean, the Bible talks about, verse 7 talks about they gave them drink and vessels of gold and silver and royal wine in abundance according to the state of the king. And verse 8, the drinking was according to the law. None didn't compel, for so the king had appointed to all the officers of his house that they should do according to every man's pleasure. And on the 7th day, verse 10, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, his thinking, his heart, his mind was influenced under the influence of this wine. He commanded these 7 chamberlains, these servants, these workers that served in the presence of Ahasuerus the king, to bring Vashti the queen before the king with a crown royal to show the people and the princess her beauty, for she was fair to look on, but the queen Vashti refused to come. Therefore, verse 12 says, was the king very wroth, and his anger burned in him. Notice verse 19. So the king was ticked. He looked for advice. Verse 19 is the advice he received. If it please the king, let there go a royal commandment from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, that it be not altered, that Vashti come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal estate unto another that is better than she. Now here's the point of all of this. As we go through this book, if that didn't happen, Esther would not be queen. So, you know, we read something like this, and hopefully you're very familiar with this whole, everything that's going on there from your own reading, your own study, or even messages that we've had. But the point that we're trying to look at is, if that, what just happened, what we just read, if that had not happened, Esther would not be in the place she was to make the difference that she ultimately made by the grace of God. Look what happened, chapter 2. I put this up. I was able to put most of this up. Esther was taken unto King Ahasuerus into his house royal, and we'll skip lots of details there about how this ever came to pass, but watch this. And the king loved Esther above all the women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Esther, as the queen, puts in the place, or she it puts her in the place, ultimately, of rescuing the Jews, and they're not even threatened yet. There's no threat to the Jewish people. There's no indication here that there's any problem. The king has no problem with them. They're just in Persia. They're prospering. But the fact is that God was working, and God was setting things up for the future that he alone knew. And we just stop there for a moment and just encourage us. We need to believe God's promises. We need to believe what God says, not when we're desperate alone, but even before we are. And just recognize that God is at work. God is teaching us things. God is preparing us, just like he prepared Esther. God is preparing circumstances that he knows all about, because he knows everything and he knows the future. He is at work, even though we don't know it. But we need to follow him and trust him. Number two, Mordecai protected the king. Here's another one. So chapter 2, verse 21, 22, and 23 says, two of the king's chamberlains were wroth. They sought to lay hand on the king Ahasuerus, and the thing was known to Mordecai, who told it unto Esther the queen. And when inquiry was found, investigation, when they researched it, when inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out. Therefore they were both hanged on a tree. And what's the point of that? The point is that Mordecai had character. Mordecai had virtue. Mordecai may not have liked everything that the king did. I don't think he liked how Haman was promoted. I don't think he liked that he authorized Haman to put into prospect the whole idea of exterminating the Jews. We don't know what else Mordecai may not have liked, but he did not like this whole idea of these two chamberlains, they're called, seeking to lay hands on the king Ahasuerus. So he exposed them to Esther. And ultimately, they were killed. They were put to death, capital punishment. It would seem like this was all for nothing, because Mordecai was never honored, never rewarded, never mentioned. Nothing ever happened to him here. Seems like it was just for nothing. And sometimes we can put ourselves in the place or be in the place where we do the right thing and we're honest and we take, you know, we go the second mile, and it just seems like it just doesn't work. Because at some points it just doesn't work and it doesn't really make sense. But we don't do the right thing so that it works. We want to do the right thing because we love our God and we trust him, see? So, God was working his plan. Here's number three, Haman was promoted. Now, what do you make of this? If there's a God who's at work, and if Haman is this villain, why did God allow this to happen? Look at our verse. After these things did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and advanced him, and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. You know how the Bible talks about how Daniel was promoted, that he was second in command, if you will, under the king? Well, that's where Haman is with a different king. Haman is right underneath the king here. He's advanced. He's seated above all the princes that were with him. Listen, think about it. Apart from this promotion, there would never have been a threat to the Jews. And we can ask ourselves, why did God let that happen? And when we think about it with history, and we know the rest of the story, and we know how it all played out, and we know that they all kind of lived happily ever after, not Haman. But when we know that, it's easy to I think, miss the significance of this and not apply it to our own lives. The reality is the ungodly do get promoted. The reality is that God does allow evil to flourish. We certainly see it flourishing even in our society, in our culture today. Why did God allow this? Listen, even this will ultimately glorify God as he overrules evil. And if every one day we will each that are saved, we will look back at our lives just like right now we're looking back at this book. And it will be like a tale that is told. But right now we're in it. We're living it. And I wonder what Mordecai thought when this happened to Haman. I don't think he would have been very happy. What do you think? I don't think he would have been really pleased. It wouldn't have seemed like being a faithful, God-fearing Jew was worth it when this guy, this creep, was advanced and promoted. Well, Mordecai hung in there. He refused to worship Haman. Next verse in that text says, "And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman." Why? Because he was promoted. For the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. Mordecai risked his life, risked his standing, risked his reputation, all for a spiritual principle. But God will surely honor his faith. But at that point, it didn't look like he was going to be honored. I mean, this king is the one who deposed his own wife, queen, because she did not do his bidding. He would not bow. The providence of God. Then Haman plotted to kill all the Jews. How could that happen? How could God let this happen? When Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence, then was Haman full of wrath. See, as the people of God, like we looked at this morning, we want to be full of joy. We want our lives to demonstrate a secure commitment to Jesus Christ that says God's plan is at work and we're going to trust him. A secure, stable confidence in our God. This man, he's full of wrath. And he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone. In other words, he thought, I'm not just going to get Mordecai and take him out. He thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had showed him the people of Mordecai. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom. Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom. Sounds like Adolf Hitler. What do you think? There's a fury here. He's full of wrath, an indignation, an overreaction, way beyond what is reasonable. But we can ask as God's children, yeah, but why did God allow this? What if we lived there? What if we lived then? What if I was Mordecai or you were Mordecai? What if you were Esther? Say, this is the kind of situations that God puts his children in. Not to hurt us as his children, but to show himself strong in the midst of these kind of struggles. There's compelling evidence here of how God can overrule evil, but God does it in his time. And we kind of wish we could speed him up sometimes. I think probably that's what Mordecai thought here. Mordecai had confidence that God was going to do something. We'll see that in a moment. Watch what God did. So Mordecai challenged Esther to talk to the king. You remember this? Then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, "Think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall there." Notice these two highlighted things here. "Then shall," Mordecai says, "then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place." That's faith. He says, there's no way that we're going to be wiped out. Mordecai says to Esther, when every indication is they're going to be wiped out. When the law of the land is that when a certain date comes, all the Jews are to be wiped out, killed, exterminated. Mordecai said, hey, you know, listen, if you know, I'll go back to it. He said, "Don't think with yourself that you shall escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knows whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? You could argue this is the bleakest moment of the threatened and planned extermination, and yet it was at that moment that Mordecai practiced his faith. He did not say, go to the king or we'll die. He said, go to the king, and if you don't, then God will deliver us some other way. But maybe this is the very reason why you have some access to the king, much more than Mordecai or any other Jew did. Mordecai practiced faith. He exercised his faith. He lived out his faith. He believed that God was ruling, and so he exercised his faith in God's providence, God's rule, God's hand at work behind the scenes, and God's plan that he could not completely perceive and didn't know the rest of the story, and he was convinced that Esther's placement and Esther's timing were exactly what God had for them. Well, you know the rest of the story. How about this? You think about the providence of God. Why did Esther request a second banquet? Now, if you're not familiar with all of this, then that might be new. But Esther went to the king, and Esther, here you go, chapter 5, verse 4, and Esther answered, if it seemed good unto the king, let the king and Haman come this day unto the banquet that I've prepared for him. And so Haman, the king, and Esther came together and had a banquet. But at the banquet, the king said, okay, Esther, what's the point? Why do you have us here? And here's what happened. Then answered Esther and said, my petition and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my petition and to perform my request, let the king and Haman come to the banquet that I shall prepare for them, and I'll do tomorrow, as the king hath said. A second banquet the next day. Why? I mean, if there is this threat upon them to exterminate the Jews, why wait another day? Why not talk to the king on that very day? Why not tell the king immediately about the threat that's in place and try to start remedying this situation? Answer, I don't have any idea. I don't have any idea why Esther asked for a second banquet. We don't have any indication in the scripture why, from the human perspective. But God knows, and God is at work doing a plan that we cannot yet see. And in the meantime, between these two banquets, we have a king that cannot sleep. Amazing story. On that night could not the king sleep. And he commanded to bring the book of records of the Chronicles. And they were read before the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh to the king's chamberlains, the keepers of the door, who sought to lay hand on the king Ahasuerus. And the king said, what honor and dignity hath been done to Mordecai for this? And then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, nothing. There's nothing done for him. So the king could not fall asleep. He asked for folks to bring in the kingdom history and to read it to him. This is between the two banquets. He can't sleep. Why couldn't he sleep? I don't know. I don't either. Maybe he couldn't sleep because he wondered what Esther was so troubled about. I don't know. Maybe he couldn't sleep because he wondered what she was going to bring up the next time. Who knows? What keeps you from sleeping? What sometimes relatively insignificant things that can keep us awake? Sometimes it's God that holds our eyes waking for his purposes, that we might seek him or pray or work through something or forgive somebody or whatever it might be. The king could not fall asleep. And so he asks for them to bring the chronicles, the history, and to read to him. Can you imagine this? You can see him in his pajamas on the throne, whatever. But they're reading this. But think about it. Who is going to do the reading? And what are they going to read? I mean, think about the history. If you were to start reading the history of just your life or the history of Hanover Baptist Church, let alone the history of this nation, I mean, who's to say, where do you want me to read? What do you want me to read about? This was a pretty recent situation. It wasn't really like it was a long time ago. Why did the king stay awake? Why didn't he fall asleep while he's being read to? Why did they come to this specific place to read about Mordecai and these two guys that threatened the king that were put to death. Amazing. Why did the king ask about a reward? Why didn't he just, eyes half closed, drifting off? I mean, he's having them read because he's trying to sleep. Why didn't he just try to make a mental note and say, maybe we'll get to it? Why did he ask about that? Not amazing questions. All of this is under the perfect rule of God for his glory. That's what we as God's children believe. That's why this is in the Bible. It is there to exalt this God who is unnamed and unmentioned God. And we get to learn from this and recognize, wow, okay, that's my Father doing that. He's at work in my life too, and in my marriage, or in my health, or in my job, or in this or that relationship, whatever it is. All these things, God's got a plan in all of that, and it's for our good, and of course for his glory to make us more like him. Then, now this is just kind of a wow thing. I didn't want to put all of this, post all of this. It's a longer passage. But if you're in Esther, look at chapter 6 and verse 4. I'll just read it to you. Amazing. So the next day, hopefully you know this, but listen again. It's just an amazing thing that happened. The king said, "Who's in the court?" Now Haman was coming to the outward court of the king's house to speak unto the king to hang Mordecai in the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's servant said unto him, "Behold, Haman stands in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." So Haman came in. And the king said unto him, "What shall be done unto the man whom the king delights to honor?" Now Haman thought in his heart, "To whom would the king delight to do honor more than to me, more than to myself?" And Haman answered the king, "For the man whom the king delights to honor, let the royal apparel be brought, which the king used to wear, and the horse that the king rides upon, and the crown royal which is set upon his head, and let this apparel and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that they may array the man with all whom the king delights to honor, and bring him on horseback through the street of the city, and proclaim before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the king whom, to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" Then the king said to Haman, "Make haste, take the apparel and the horse. I like your idea. As thou hast said, and do even so to Mordecai the Jew that sits at the king's gate. Let nothing fail of all that thou hast spoken." Then took Haman the apparel and the horse and arrayed Mordecai and brought him on horseback through the street of the city and proclaimed before him, "Thus shall it be done unto the man whom the king delights to honor." What do you think about that? Talk about the providence of God. Haman is right there at the right place at the right time, right at the door. The king says, "Who is in the court?" And it wasn't Esther this time. It was Haman. It wasn't some other chamberlain. It was Haman. It was the right person at the right place at the right time. Or if you're Haman, you say, "I'm the wrong person in the wrong place at the wrong time." But that was God's person right there. Wow. Now Haman the killer is Haman the proclaimer of the honor of Mordecai. But we're not done yet, because there's still a plot to kill all the Jews. But now we know why Esther had a second banquet, because all this happened between the banquets. He couldn't sleep. The king couldn't sleep. He had all this read. So anyway, now we know. God's plan. And then they come to the second banquet. Chapter 7, verse 1. So the king and Haman came to banquet with Esther the queen. Verse 6. And Esther said, "The adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman." Then Haman was afraid before the king and the queen. And the king, arising from the banquet of wine in his wrath, went into the palace garden. And Haman stood up to make request for his life to Esther the queen, for he saw that there was evil determined against him by the king. And the king returned out of the palace garden into the place of the banquet of wine. And Haman was fallen upon the bed whereon Esther was. And said the king, "Will he force the queen also before me in the house?" As the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. And Harbona, one of the chamberlains, said before the king, "Hey, behold, there's a gallows already. Behold also the gallows 50 cubits high, which Haman had made for Mordecai, who had spoken good for the king, stands in the house of Haman." Then the king said, "Hang him thereon." So they hanged Haman on the gallows, that he had prepared for Mordecai, and then was the king's wrath pacified. This banquet, where this happened, came after the sleepless night, after the reading of history, after the reward of Mordecai, and we see God's amazing and beautiful plan come to full fruition next. Because there's still this plot for all the Jews to be killed. But watch this. Chapter 8. Verse 1. On that day did the king Ahasuerus give the house of Haman, the Jews' enemy, unto Esther the queen. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was unto her. And the king took off his ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it unto Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. Verse 7. Then the king Ahasuerus said unto Esther the queen and to Mordecai the Jew, Behold, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and him they have hanged upon the gallows, because he laid his hand upon the Jews. Write ye also for the Jews, as it likes you, in the king's name, and seal it with the king's ring, for the writing which is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's ring may no man reverse. And then finally, chapter 10, all the way at the end of the book, verse 3. For Mordecai the Jew was next unto King Ahasuerus. That's what it had said about Haman. But now it says Mordecai the Jew was next unto King Ahasuerus, and great among the Jews, and accepted of the multitude of his brethren, seeking the wealth of his people, and speaking peace to all his seed. God's overruling providence is so evident. Even when God is silent, his working is undeniable to his followers if we're paying attention, right? And if we have faith and we're believing God's word. The book of Esther demonstrates God's providential rule. The Old Testament is this demonstration of God's ruling throughout just innumerable issues. But the New Testament doesn't merely demonstrate it. The New Testament declares it. This famous and well-loved and wonderful promise and declaration of God, Romans 8:28, we know, as believers, we know, as the children of God, we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose. So what lessons can we take away for living? Well, here's one. Life is difficult. Life is hard. Life has all kinds of things we don't understand. Life has all kinds of ups and downs and all kinds of reversals. But as the people of God, let us resist losing courage. Let us try to resist just somehow losing heart and losing courage and losing our faith and losing our confidence in God when reversals happen. That's one thing. Here's another one. Rather than losing courage and being discouraged, may the Lord help us to trust him and look for his hand and look at what's happening and really look for God's hand and praise him even before we see the evidence of his hand working out. Why? Because God is in control, God is working, and God is always right on time.